So I'm going to start by saying Merry Christmas. I do know the date. I should say Happy Valentine's, but I just want you to raise your hand. How many of you know the story of the three wise men? Anybody know the story? Oh, wow, look at that. Pretty much everybody here knows the story, which is really good because then I can just tell the story as we kind of take a look at a little bit of this passage. The story of the wise men coming is really not a Christmas story. We often call it a Christmas story. It's not a Christmas story. In fact, it takes place a good while later than the birth of Jesus. But it's a story of these, how do you even describe them? Magi, astronomers, wise men, some might say fortune tellers of looking it through astronomy. But however you would describe these people, they see a star. And Matthew tells us in Matthew chapter 2, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him. What most of us remember of the story of the wise men, or the magi, is the star. The star is the central theme of that particular telling of those particular people. How many they were, you know, we say three because of the three gifts, but you know, forget all that for a moment. Just come back to our text, our scripture that God gives us. These men were in the east, traveling now west to Jerusalem. So they are from the east. And they say, they get to Jerusalem, and they're a little shocked because they were expecting something more than what was going on. They get to Jerusalem, and they say, where is he who was born king of the Jews? So it would make perfect sense that if under your understanding of this star that you saw sometime in the past, okay, we don't know exactly when it was. Herod's going to try to figure out some dates. But the bottom line is it was in the past. I saw the star. And presumably, if you just read through the Matthew account, presumably the star is seen and then gone. Like we don't get anything else of the story. And that star has whatever happened at that point in time somehow convinced these men, however you might define them, that something great happened. And I think they're even believing that it had to be more than just a young prince that was born. It had to be something different than that. I'm not sure that they have a full understanding. In fact, I'm pretty sure they don't have a full understanding. But whatever it is, they see this light, this star. They determine that it's coming from the west because they're in the east. They saw it coming. Saw it, and so they decided we need to go to Israel, and the place for a king to be born would have been the capital city. So, I mean, it's a go figure. So they get there, and they ask the question, so where is this one who was born king of the Jews? Now, since you know the story, you know, Herod kind of hears what's going on, and Herod has a reputation. His reputation, and we might even get into it on some Wednesday nights, but his reputation is basically, if he thinks someone's going to take the throne, he'll kill you. That's pretty much his go-to MO. So he hears this idea of a king. He is the reigning monarch, albeit by way of Rome, but still he is the reigning monarch. And he knows it's not talking about a child of his. Because what he does is he calls together the chief priest and the scribes. And he asks them the question, where is the Christ to be born? Herod knows his scripture well enough and has an understanding that is deep enough that when these people come, whatever it is that they saw that gave them this idea that it was a king of the Jews that was being born, he has already translated that into his head as the Messiah, the predicted one from the prophets of old, has somehow entered into life. And he wants to know, according to the prophets, where is the Christ, the Messiah, to be born? They quote scripture to Herod and they say Bethlehem. So he has this discussion. And when he gets done with that discussion, he goes back to the Magi. And so they're not aware of all that has been going on. And he says, here's what I've ascertained. And that is that the Christ is to be born in Bethlehem, just literally just in the shadow, if you will, of Jerusalem, just a few miles away. He finds out the time in which they saw that star. And he's doing some calculations in his head. And he puts on his best poker face possible and he says, go worship him. When you find where he is, come back and tell me so I can go and worship this new king of the Jews. And then we read, and I'm going to begin with verse 9. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen, so this is past tense, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And it's really some compound wording that's going on there. But they had this great exceeding joy. So the star that they had seen that got them onto this journey now shows up again as they're going towards Bethlehem. In fact, it leads them to the house. Jesus isn't in a barn anymore. This has been enough time period. They're in a rented home. It leads them to a house where Jesus is. And somehow can pinpoint the house. I've been out on a lot of starry nights and I've seen, you know, pictures and taken pictures of starry nights, and you can see sometimes the rays coming down. I've never had a pinpoint a home in my life. Okay? So whatever is going on with this star, they are absolutely overjoyed. The star brought them to the very one that they had come. And of course they go in and they give the gifts and they see the baby, and then they have a dream that says, don't go back to Herod, go home a different way. And so they do, and Joseph gets up and he takes Mary and Jesus, and they leave and go down to Egypt. Now, why do I tell you that story? Why do I even begin? I begin there because I want to talk about something that shines like a star, that its very purpose is to bring people to Jesus. And that is exactly what happened back in that time. Now, Jesus himself would call himself the morning star in the book of Revelation. The idea of a star or a light is often done, I guess, metaphorically speaking, in the Bible. It's often this difference between that which is holy and righteous and good and pure, and that which is dark and evil and sinful. So you get the light-darkness contrast quite a bit that goes on. And sometimes that light is described in different ways, and we're going to see here in just a moment a translation where it's going to talk about a star. But the idea behind it is that light is there to illuminate, to shine for a purpose. So I want us to, I'm going to jump over to Philippians chapter 2, and this is where we're going to be today anyway. We're going to just be in several verses. We're going to look at, I'm going to take it out of its context, and then I'm going to put it back into context. I told Carrie, I said, my sermon is discombobulated today, and I probably should have arranged it differently. But I just want to start here for just a moment. Philippians 2, beginning with verse 15. I have two different translations up here on the screen, and here's the reason why. When people translate from, in this particular case, the Greek to the English language, many times the group of people that are doing the translating, whether it be a committee or whoever it is doing the translating, has to sit down with the best knowledge that they have of what those Greek words would have meant at the time in which they were written, so for us 2,000 years ago, and bring it into a way of expressing it that would make sense to us in English. I know no other foreign language. I did grow up speaking Welsh. I couldn't speak Welsh today if I tried. I can count. That's about the only thing I can do. But because of living in Wales as a little child, I had to learn that language. I had to learn it in school. I was three when we moved over there. It was this language that was spoken around me in the school. So it was a language that I spoke. Okay. I remember traveling with Mom and Dad one time, and we went on a little vacation in Wales, and we were at like a bed and breakfast, and the couple were talking. Actually, I don't remember. My parents tell me this or told me this. They were talking about those Yanks that were staying at the house, my mom and dad and us kids, brother and sister at that time. And I just started speaking Welsh to them, and they got really afraid because I could understand every single thing they were saying behind my mom and dad's back. But nonetheless, I tell you that little caveat that really wasn't even in my notes. Don't know why I went there. I tell you that because when you're translating from Greek into English, you have to pick words that you think best express the intent of what's going on. So the NIV puts it this way, and again, I'm taking these a little bit out of their context, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault, and a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like stars in the universe as you hold out the word of life. The English Standard, which is what I normally use, says that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. Different, just a little bit different wording there, holding fast to the word of life. In these passages, the wording that is used is not technically star like we saw in the book of Matthew. It is this word that gets translated shine or lights, or it's about illumination. Okay, it's about brightness. And so the NIV really thought the best way of helping us in English understand that is when you go outside at night and you look up in a sky and you see all the lights and they're the stars, and they're just, they can literally illuminate even what's on the ground in front of you. And so the idea that is being expressed is that we become, in the midst of this crooked generation, this twisted generation, this evil generation, we become the light, the illumination, the star, as we hold fast or hold out the word of life. That is what we are supposed to do. The second phrase, and then I'm going to come back and make the illustration. The second phrase, word of life, is just as powerful as this idea of stars in the universe or lights in the world. It's the logos. Remember John 1:1? That in the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We are holding out, we are shining so brightly as we hold out Jesus to the world around us. We're holding out the very message, essence of life in the person of Jesus. Our desire this year is to shine like stars, is to have spiritual conversations. So in the past, you've seen these little things put into your bulletin. And what happens is whenever you have a spiritual conversation, what we're asking you to do, and I'm now pleading you to do, begging you to do, if I need to get down on my knees, I will, is anytime you have really a spiritual conversation, just put the initials of somebody on one of these little cards, tear it off, and there's a little box there in the back, and just drop it in there. And what Pat and Alan have been doing is cutting out these stars and putting them like we have up front here with those initials on them. Now let's illustrate this for just a moment. I want to turn off the lights. For us, as we hold out the word of life, we shine like these stars. In this room, as dark as we have it at this moment in time, your eyes are drawn to these stars. You can't help yourself. You just look. Our role this year is to be the star. I'll go ahead and let you turn the light back on. Because if you leave it like this, you'll fall asleep and there'll just be a big headlight on me. So I want to take this idea that's put on these two front banners. And I want to put it back into at least a little bit more of its context, okay? So let's back up just a couple of verses. So as Paul writing to the church in Philippi, chapter 2, we're going to begin in verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but also much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. When I began to put this particular lesson together, and I'm a context person, I really think you need to like read the whole chapter. You're better off reading the whole book, even if you're only going to study two verses. Just put it right back where it belongs. As you come back at least to this shorter section of the verses above and below where we're going to be reading today, I felt guilt. I felt guilt. And the reason why I felt guilt is here is this church that has its own difficulties. It's not a perfect church by any means. There are people in there that they've got some old ladies that are, I say old, they've got some women that are bickering with one another, but yet they're good Christian women and they got a great love for God and worked well with Paul. But the bottom line is, it's not a perfect church. It's just not, okay? It's not a perfect church. And he says, you guys have always been obedient. While I've told you I was the perfect child growing up in our family of three, my older brother and younger sister, I was only the perfect child because my brother was a rebellious brat. And so it made me look good. Okay? It made me look good. And I was wise enough not to do the dumb things that he did. Let me put it this way. I didn't get caught doing what he did openly. Let's just put it that. We'll be really honest. When we think about obedience, we really do come to either our childhood or our children and our relationship with them. When we talk about obeying, not just when mom and dad are there, not just when Paul was present, but being obedient to God, even without having that, quote, authority figure looking down upon you, that's pretty impressive. And I'm thinking to myself, man, how many times have I really been disobedient to God? Okay. And somehow in my head, it's almost like I think God doesn't even see what I'm doing at the moment in time. Like, that's really stupid. But it's where my mind goes. Paul says, you guys have been obedient. Not perfect, you've been obedient. And he makes this phrase, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. I'll tell you, most of my childhood growing up, and I'm not putting it on my dad who was a preacher, but most of my childhood growing up, I really thought that what this verse was telling me was I needed to do everything right or God wasn't going to save me. And that's kind of where I got to with it. That I had to work out I had to get me right in order for God to decide he wanted to save me. That his grace wasn't good enough. My obedience had to be better than his grace. So I had to work out so I pretended to live a life, hence that phrase, the perfect child. And I know we laugh at it. Some of the people did call me that only because I was very good at covering up the evil that I had done or within me. And verses like this scared me. But it's really the opposite of what Paul is actually saying. What he is saying, this idea of working out, this idea is bring it to its full conclusion. Bring your salvation to its full conclusion. And not with fear and trembling in the sense that I'm afraid of going to hell, but I'm bringing this because God is who he is. And so with this reverence that I have for God, this holiness that I have coming before God because of who God is, just who he is, I am so thankful that I can take one step at a time. So I can't forget verse 13, for it is God who works in, and I'll just change it, in me, in Jeffrey, both to will and to do work for his good pleasure. So it's never even about me, okay? I've made it about me. I've made this passage so much about me, but it's really not. It's about God saying, I want to use you because you have a heart that is opening yourself up to obedience. You are striving to do that which is good and holy and lovely and wonderful. That's who you are. And yes, you have failed along the way, but you are striving. You really are working out. You're bringing to conclusion that salvation that I've placed within you with this reverence and awe that you have for me. So I am going to go to work in you. And I'm going to use you as my conduit. And that changes how I come at this section. Because the verses that follow it, let's just keep going, verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent children without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life. I'm going to stop there. I know that's the middle of a verse or the beginning of a verse. But that context that we were talking about earlier, being lights of the world, is based earlier on this context, verses 12 and 13, that God is doing work in me. That I am bringing to fullness, to completion, the work of salvation that God has already started it within me. And as he is working in me, as he is doing his will within my life, my response to that God working in me is to do things, how's this, without grumbling. I like at least verse 14 in the ESV says questioning. There are other words that are used in different translations. Most of them pick out grumbling though. And what I'm really thankful for is none of you ever grumble. And it's just kind of a Jeffrey issue. Because grumbling has as its heart selfishness. I only grumble when something isn't the way I want it to be. That's why I grumble. If it's the way I want things to be, I'm not grumbling. I'm not complaining. I'm not questioning. I'm not doubting because everything is going the way I want it to be. So if I am grumbling or if I am doubting, questioning, complaining, It's because things aren't the way I want them. I want what I want when I want it. And that's just the way life goes. So when I don't get what I want when I want it, then, and we use this term complaining. I would guess most everybody in here leads a double life to some degree. I'm just guessing. We're not always exactly the way we are in this worship service when we're getting cut off on the road as you're driving down to DC. Okay. That's, you know, traffic issues. Okay. It's not the way things always are when you go to the grocery store and you only need three items and they happen to be out of two of them at the grocery store. And you're like, why? I drove all the way over here. And how can their shelves be empty? Don't they realize that people need these things? I come into the store to buy these things and they're not even. He said, I want you to live your life without this great need to grumble. Which is, get out of me and in a situation where most people would grumble, I want you to be blameless, innocent, children of God without blemish, because we do live in a world that is twisted. We live in a world that is darkness. We live in a world that is sinful. We live in a world that says, I want whatever it is, alternative lifestyles. And I'm not putting any one thing out there. I'm just saying we're willing to even change terminology so that we don't have to deal with reality of what God has taught. So we'll just change the terminology. We live in a very twisted time. Now, here's the interesting thing. So did Paul 2,000 years ago. So if you think we're just, you know, going to the south end of Hades, okay, if you think that's what's happening to the United States of America, I can guarantee you that was going on in first century Rome. I can guarantee you. His point is, I want you to shine as a light in this twisted, warped world. I want you to hold fast, hold out, cling and give the word, the logos of life. That's what I want you to do. So when Paul talks to these Christians, he places this need to shine in the context of the world that they really do know and understand has fallen apart around them. And the reason why it is always. And I know that that's an extreme word. It is always because Jesus isn't being honored. Always. Because when Jesus is honored, that chaos is turned into his peace. So they don't even know their chaos is being without Christ. They don't know that. I cannot. Carrie was texting with a young person and having a conversation, and this person was having some difficulty and had done some things that weren't great, and she was having this conversation with this person. And my first thought was, I just can't believe, because I know this person, I just can't believe they are behaving the way they're behaving. And my second thought sitting there as she was telling me was, but this person is not saved. They're actually behaving the exact way they think they ought to behave. They don't know any better. They know life is terrible. They know that the things that they have done have consequences to it. but they haven't brought Jesus into their life enough to see what it could be. And so proud of my wife. So she shines as a star to this person and begins this texting spiritual conversation with this person, seeking to bring her closer to God and helping her to find a place where she might interact with Christian people. Now, I was doing a little grumbling on the couch because I wanted to watch TV and she was having this conversation. Paul says, shine like that star, that light in the world. Wrap this up. Finishing 16 and finishing out this paragraph at least. Holding fast the word of life so that in the day of Christ, I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain, even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith. I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. Paul's statement to these disciples is simply, I am so proud of you. I'm proud that you are striving to be obedient, even when I'm not there. I'm proud that you are living your life so different from the world, that you shine like a star, that you beam brightly. Paul says, I'm proud of you. Having been a part of this congregation for close to 3 years now, I would say the same thing. I'm proud of you. I'm proud that this congregation has a desire that says, we know we need to have more spiritual conversation. And we're going to push ourselves to do that. You know, many of us have probably had the opportunity to share Jesus with our family, our friends, our co-workers, our neighbors, the people that we're around most of the time. And so we come to a year like this and we think, well, I've already talked to everybody that I know. I hear you. You know what this year is really about? It's about talking to the people you don't know. It's about bringing Jesus into conversations yet to come. It is about living your life in such a way that when you have that conversation, they already can tell just by who you are, just in the moments they've been with you, that you're a little bit different than everybody else. I'm not asking them to grasp all of Christianity in one conversation. I'm just saying we begin to have that conversation even with people we don't know. And for me, that's the scary part. I hate putting numbers out there, but I'm going to give you one. My goal for this year is to have 50 different spiritual conversations. It's a Jeffrey goal. Not putting that on anybody else. My desire would be able to put one of those little squares inside that box every week all the way through the end of the year. I would love to be able to do that. And before I give myself any grace as far as saying, well, you know, if you don't, it's okay because you've done 25, okay? I'm not beating myself up. But I'm also not going to let myself off the hook. I'm not going to say, well, 25 is okay. So really, I will say 50, but if I get to 25, I'm going to feel really good. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say 50. Because if I don't say 50, I wouldn't even get to 25. I probably wouldn't even get to 5. Okay? I've got to I've got to put something out there for me to be reaching towards. And I've already begun having conversations with most of the people that I know. And this is only February. And so now I'm going to have to start having conversations with people I don't know. And it scares the mess out of me. It just does. Because I'm having to look for opportunity. So I have different people praying for me. Would you pray for me? I've asked several people in this congregation. Pray for me that God would just open a door for me to have a conversation. Just to bring Jesus into the conversation. I'm not there to sell them anything. I'm not there to sell them this church. I do believe if they fall in love with Jesus, they're going to want to worship Jesus. And they're going to want to worship with people of like faith. Trickle-down effect, I think, yes, it comes here. But my goal is to just have the conversation. My goal is to shine like a star so that when the day comes that either I leave this earth or you leave this earth or Jesus comes again, we can say, I'm proud. I'm proud of what we have done. I'm proud of how we've stood with Jesus Christ. I'm proud of how we opened our mouth instead of kept it closed. I'm proud of how we lived differently. I'm proud of what we are doing and now experiencing eternity with Christ. So yeah, I'm a hard-fighting soldier on that battlefield. And the end result of what I want is for Jesus to shine and shine through me so that I can be a light in this world. If you need some help or prayers or strength, if you just need that spiritual encouragement, it's not about a confession of sin. Sometimes you just need somebody that'll hold your hand, that'll walk with you, that'll pray with you. If we can help you, then won't you come as we stand and as we sing?